Alicia, don't you dare. Alicia, shut up. Look, they're looking at you too. Stop playing games.
And sometimes it can jump across the wires. The wires.
What's a cow going to do to me? Push you down the hills on the rock.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Summer is winding down and kids are heading back to school, so this month, a picture of Wyoming's youth. In the summer, a nature conservancy program called LEAF offers urban high schoolers the chance to live and work in the shadow of Heart Mountain, north of Cody. The hope is to get the kids to love Wyoming so much they'll come back for its colleges and its jobs in conservation. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards joined them on a day of clipping and pruning.
Oh, here's one. Just about to miss it.
Floppy sun hats float over waist-deep grasses along a lush irrigation ditch. The cliffs of Heart Mountain loom above. Kiaria Mack and Jaslyn Moore wear leather work gloves and carry serious-looking clippers and plastic bags. They are hunting the hillside for hound's tongue, an invasive plant species. Mac calls it vicious.
They have a little purplish color to it. So what you do is you have to cut from the bottom. You can't cut where the seeds are because it gets stuck to your clothes. And if it goes back into the ground, it grows again. So you have to make sure you get to a certain spot. And
she snips off a lanky plant with dark, spinachy-looking leaves and stuffs it into her garbage bag. What do they have against this innocuous-looking plant?
It shuts down your liver functions, well, the animal's liver functions when they eat it, so they die, so it's not really good, and it's invasive. So basically it takes nutrients that the native plants need.
That's Alicia Griffin, another intern awarded a competitive spot in a paid work-study program through the Nature Conservancy. The program is called LEAF. Carrie Peters is the program's coordinator.
The LEAF program is an internal conservancy program and stands for Leaders in Environmental Action for the Future.
Peter says the aim of the program is to transplant urban kids into wild places like Heart Mountain Ranch. But it's not a guest ranch. They do real work, like removing barbed wire from wildlife migration routes or building trails. To get in, these students have to attend a Nature Conservancy-approved high school, which means they have a conservation curriculum. But that's not all.
We had to fill out an application, 3 essays, and then they called us, letting us know that we had an interview, and it was about 24 of us that they chose.
And so what do you think that it was that you all had in common that set you apart?
We like adventure.
This year's group is from Arabia Mountain High in Atlanta, Georgia, and they're all aspiring doctors and engineers. But Griffin admits her plans are still forming.
I was either going to do graphic art or some type of science, and I think I'm kind of leaning towards wildlife biology because you get to do this.
And Peter says that's the point of the program, to get kids into conservation when they're deciding their futures.
When they do decide to go to college and they hit the job market and stuff, they had this experience here in Wyoming like, oh, yeah, you know, that was really cool what we did there, that stewardship stuff we did on Heart Mountain Ranch. And maybe I'd be interested in, you know, looking for a job to do something similar like that.
Peter says the idea is to help them fall in love with place, with a capital P. For this year's crop, the program succeeded in spades.
We don't get breezes in Georgia. It's just like, get off the plane. So the wind was so nice. I think that was the first thing I liked about it was the wind. And then I noticed the mountains and everything. But I think the wind drew me in.
The air.
At the end of the day, the interns cart their heavy bags full of hound's tongue back to the truck and heap them high to burn back at the ranch. Nearby, a few cattle are grazing. The students might like adventure, but when it comes to cows...
Alicia, don't you dare. Alicia, shut up. Look, they're looking at you too. Stop playing games.
And sometimes they can jump across the wires.
Keep playing. They come right across from here. We're leaving you right here.
And they can't walk the wires.
What's a cow going to do to me? Push you down the hills on their rocks.
They might be on the brink of making bright futures in conservation careers far from home, but for now, they're still just kids. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
LEAF operates in 26 states across the U.S. This is their 21st year of providing youth programs. Data released in June by the U.S. Department of Education shows Wyoming schools refer students to law enforcement at rates twice the national average. In the wake of high-profile tragedies, more schools hire armed police officers to patrol their hallways. And as Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank tells us, encounters between students and the law create unexpected problems.
In the 2011-2012 school year, Wyoming ranked fourth in the country for sending students to cops and courts, and Cheyenne's Johnson Junior High School referred students to law enforcement at a rate 15 times the national average.
I started at Johnson in the fall of 2011.
Manny Fardella is a school resource officer, or SRO, with the Cheyenne Police Department.
Johnson was a busy school. You know, they did have a lot of disturbances, fights, and there was some drug activity. There was a whole bunch of things going on.
Students were reported to police 88 times that year, but Fardella says things have changed since then.
Every single year, we have had a drastic decrease in negative behavior. I think Johnson has made remarkable progress, and our numbers are way down.
New data shows that the school logged just 9 referrals 2 years later. But the reductions in contacts with police were not the case everywhere. The referral rate at Rock Springs High School tripled during that period. Fardella says numbers will go down only when officers are properly trained to build relationships with kids and work closely with school staff.
It either works or it doesn't, and if you don't have the right person in there, it's not going to work. And then when it doesn't work, you have negative results from that.
University of Wyoming criminal science professor Thomas Mowen sees a lot of negative results.
You have law enforcement agencies who are pushing the SRO agenda, saying it increases safety. There's absolutely no evidence that that's the case. In fact, the evidence is on the other side, and that is by putting an SRO in the school, you're inflating the arrest rates.
There are officers at about 32% of Wyoming schools, slightly above average. Wyoming boosted school safety and security in the wake of the killings in Newtown, which Mowen says doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Your odds of being involved in a school shooting are similar to being struck by lightning. And yet we're making policy for something that is extremely rare.
And Mowen says researchers in his field have found that school resource officers actually have negative impacts on education.
There's tons of research that shows that these security measures are related to lower student attendance, higher dropout rates, higher pushout rates, lower SAT taking, lower grades. I mean, pretty much every negative outcome, there's a straight line to at this point in the literature.
What's the upside to SROs in schools if there is one?
There is no upside to having SROs in schools.
Mowen says SROs often criminalize normal childhood behavior. Students face charges like defiance of authority and are funneled from the classroom to the courtroom. And the data shows that students of color and those with disabilities are more likely to have run-ins with police than other students.
We've seen a massive increase in inequality in discipline because of schools adopting formal criminal justice policies.
In Wyoming, schools are twice as likely to call the cops on students with disabilities. This year, a mom in southeast Wyoming will call Karen because she fears using her name could lead to retribution from her school district, says she got a call that her 8-year-old son with autism was acting out at school. So she hopped in her car.
Even though I was on my way, they decided to call a police officer to intervene.
Some SROs showed up just after she did and restrained her son. Karen says he was terrified.
Why is the go-to reaction to behaviors that are a known result of his disability to bring in an officer? Being confronted in the middle of an escalation by someone who's an authority figure and who has a weapon on them and who is trained to deal with criminals, you know, not an 8-year-old.
Karen's son had another run-in with an officer when he tried to walk out of school during the day. The local police department says officers do attend 1-week-long training that includes some information about students with disabilities. But Karen says police presence only made things worse.
My child is now afraid of police officers. He views them as someone who's brought in to scare him or deter him. And he, at this point, would not ask a police officer for help.
Wyoming is one of 38 states that does not require school resource officers to have any specific training on how to deal with kids. But Cheyenne PD's Manny Fardella is trained and even trains others around the country. He says that training is critical and good SROs must be understanding.
One of the biggest things that I always stress when I teach an SRO class is the question of why. We have to dig deep and find out, really, why is the student doing what they do?
That's typically not the mentality for cops who come straight from policing the streets to policing the schools.
Okay, school resource officers dealing with misbehavior in schools. Now for a man who makes sure the kids get there in the first place. Most people on the Wind River Indian Reservation have seen Craig Ferris on the sidelines of the basketball court at Wyoming Indian High School. As head coach, he's led the Chiefs to 4 state championships. But most days, Ferris can be found driving around and knocking on doors, putting the full court press on a major problem for reservation schools: attendance. Ferris works for Wyoming Indian Elementary, and Aaron Schrenk joined him for a standard day on the job.
Craig Ferris begins his morning behind the wheel of a black Suburban, armed with a thick stack of envelopes. But before he delivers those, he's got to make a quick stop.
I usually have to come get these guys at least once a week, so.
Ferris is what's called a homeschool coordinator, a job that seems to be equal parts mailman, social worker, and taxi driver.
It's kind of like the truant officer. My job is to make sure the kids who aren't coming to school find out why and what we need to do to get them to school. Morning, Talissa.
Third grader Talissa Kadat missed the school bus this morning.
My dad forgot to wake me up, so he called this guy.
Ferris' school district had the second lowest attendance rate in the state last year. At Wyoming Indian Elementary, the number of students who are chronically absent or missing more than 10% of school days has been double the state average.
What's one of the top things that really plague a kid's development in school? If they're not in school, they're not learning. All right, have a good day.
Thanks for the ride.
All right, we'll drop some letters off.
To fix the problem, Ferris's main job is what's inside those envelopes. Notices for parents whose children have missed too many school days. When kids have 5, 10, or 15 unexcused absences, he shows up to their door with a letter.
A lot of parents know they're not sending their kids to school. They know why I'm visiting, so they're not going to answer the door.
A copy of each of these letters is also sent to the tribal prosecutor's office. Parents who can't get their kids to school can be charged with educational neglect and face probation and fines. So Ferris, who stands 6'6", is no stranger to rustling blinds and sideways stares, but he understands what parents are going through.
A majority of our parents are trying. They are doing what it takes to get their kids to school. You know, even if they don't have a lot, they're doing it.
And some parents are even happy to see him, like Rakina Armour.
If he knocks on the door, is it a good thing or a bad thing?
A good thing. He is the coach.
Don't be shy.
The best coach we have.
I need to get me some dog biscuits or something.
Yeah.
Ferris has done this job for about 6 years, but he's been coaching basketball twice as long.
Everybody knows I coach the high school team, so when I deliver letters, they're always asking me about the boys and the team and how we're going to do this year. And I think that kind of helps me out because most people know who I am.
After a few more deliveries, Ferris is called back to the school to take a sick student home. In the nurse's office, we bump into Ferris's mom, Donna Highwalker.
And what are you doing? Following my son around?
Following him around, yeah. What should I know about Craig?
I don't want to say.
Highwalker works at the school as a literacy interventionist. In fact, most of the family works here, she tells me.
Yeah, we end up getting all hired. Well, I'm the one that first started. I've been here about, this is my 29th year. I got hired, my husband got hired, and then I think you?
Ferris was born and raised here. He went to elementary school here, played high school basketball here. He left to play college ball, but came back. He says this is exactly where he wants to be.
I really don't see myself doing anything else.
Ferris is like a liaison between the school and students' homes. Now he's on the hunt for some kids who haven't been at school all week. He's got a few different addresses for them. Nobody answers the door at the first two. He learns the kids are in Casper, visiting a family member in the hospital. Family illness is a big reason many of his kids miss school. The reservation is home to many large extended families, and Ferris says they're big on coming together during trying times. Another cause for absence, he says, is the fact that the reservation is more than 3,000 square miles.
It's so vast, where our kids are coming from. You know, if they're not catching the bus, it's pretty hard for them to find a ride to school, especially with the socioeconomic aspect of it.
And Ferris says some students living in tough conditions have bigger worries than getting to school on time.
I've been to houses where nobody should be living there type of thing, and bad things are happening in the house. And I've seen a lot, dealt with a lot, reported a few things.
But mostly what he sees when he knocks on doors all over the reservation are parents who want the best for their kids.
You really see kind of where people, parents, and families are struggling, and, you know, it might not look like they're trying, but they are. They're doing what they can. You know, what's that saying? Doing what they can with what they have. So, it's a tough life out here.
After a day out in the field, Ferris parks his SUV and pours over attendance data in his office. He stacks another thick pile of envelopes and maps out his route for tomorrow. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schrank.
In classical music, there's a long list of composers who are also conductors. One of them is Chicagoan Jim Stevenson. He's created an interactive concert program aimed specifically at young audiences. Steven has performed his Compose Yourself program hundreds of times since 2002, and a couple of years ago he brought the work to Casper, Wyoming. I asked him how a concert could be composed in the moment. So plenty of composers conduct, but I've never heard of a composer composing during a concert.
We teach the kids about melody, harmony, and rhythm. What we do is we give them three choices of each. So we present three melodies to them. And then they choose one. And then we present three harmonies to them, and they choose one of those. And then three rhythms, and they choose one of those. And I've written those melodies, harmonies, and rhythms so that they can all go together no matter which one they choose. So it's like a sport. You never know what the result's going to be. It gets the kids involved. I love the interactive part.
Well, from watching these on YouTube, they seem to have a tremendous amount of fun with them. And I wondered, one thing is you offer major harmony, which we would all recognize as being happy sounding, and minor harmony as being a bit sadder sounding, and then dissonant harmony. Do you find the kids leaning towards one over the other more consistently?
You know, every time I'm surprised, I have to admit. There's I'm watching the kids' faces as they're listening, and I'm always expecting them to pick one, and they always surprise me. Besides the actual harmony, the one that gets chosen the most, I would say, is actually the tango, the rhythm. When they hear the tango, they end up choosing that one. So the harmony and the melodies are usually, I can never predict what they're going to go for, but the tango seems to really excite them the most, which is one of the three rhythms.
The other two being a waltz and a march.
Right.
Well, tell me about creating these building blocks, because that must be incredibly difficult to have three different melodies, three different harmonies, three different rhythms, and they can fit together in any permutation. How do you even go about doing that? It seems like just a giant math problem.
It was exactly that. And I happen to like math, so I guess that part of it was interesting to me. But the first thing I did was I made it easy on myself by at least working with C major to begin with, so there were no sharps or flats to deal with. And then, you know, the relative minor, A minor, is similar. But, yeah, I still remember sitting in the room where I was composing those three melodies. And I was like, oh, that note isn't going to work, and I had to go back and fix it. And then if I fixed that note, it meant I had to fix another note and then check that one through. So it was quite a process, I have to confess.
And how did you get the idea for doing this?
I wanted it to be more than just learning what an orchestra play, the instruments. I wanted it to be more than just the instruments, but also what goes into composing a piece so that they can have more of an appreciation of the music they hear, whether it's rock music or jazz music or classical music. Just so they understand the behind-the-scenes aspect a little bit more.
Well, and speaking of audience appreciation, a lot of people fret over the aging and possible decline of classical music audiences, of orchestral audiences. Do you feel like this is doing some part in building new audiences, bringing in a younger generation?
I certainly hope so. I mean, I remember seeing a show when I was a kid, you know, an orchestra coming to my school. And it obviously had an effect on me. I became a professional musician And so I'm hoping that in some small way, whether it's one kid out of 1,500 in the audience that ends up becoming a musician or has more of an appreciation for music, then it's a success, I believe. I just want them to have fun. Every note that these kids hear when we do this piece is original music by a living composer. And so that in and of itself is rare for them. There doesn't need to be this wall between classical music and enjoyment. And I think that sometimes becomes the perception.
And what about the musicians in the orchestra who are performing this? This has to be a pretty unusual experience for them. Normally they know in advance what they're going to be playing.
Well, I have to say it's been so gratifying that everywhere I've done it, there have been so many of the players who come up to me and they just say, this is the best show we've ever done. It's so engaging. It's so fun. And the thing I love when I hear them say is, you know, it's fun for us to play as well.
That's composer Jim Stevenson. The Albany County School District was close to becoming the first in Wyoming to pass a policy protecting transgender students. Now, amid national debate, school officials are dragging their feet. And in response, a transgender high schooler is running for school board to save it. Aaron Schrank brings us that story.
At a recent school board meeting in Laramie, high school senior Rihanna Kelver showed up with a call to action.
I am asking that the board take initiative now to protect these students. As soon as we lose a student by the 50% rate suicide that transgender youth face, the blood will be on our hands.
18-year-old Calver is one of a few transgender kids in Laramie. She's been working with the board on a policy for months, and she's been a living, breathing rebuttal to those who've dismissed that policy as a solution in search of a problem.
A couple of people opened with, who is this policy even helping? So it was kind of nice to be able to stand up and say, hey, I'm right here.
Back in January, the school board came up with two drafts of their plan. They both do things like require teachers to use students' preferred names and pronouns, but there's one major difference. One lets transgender students use the bathrooms that match their gender identity. The other makes them use bathrooms that match their biological sex. But after a legal dust-up in North Carolina, the school board decided it wasn't the right time to move forward with either.
They were worried about litigation on either side.
Kelver's petitioning the board to pass the one that would guarantee she could use the girls' restroom and says it can't wait. That's why she's decided to run for a seat on the board herself. For 2 years, Kelver was relegated to a single-stall bathroom in her school's special ed wing.
Most of my classes were actually on the other wing, and so it was constantly having to travel there, you know, wasting the class time I needed. And eventually I just kind of stopped using it more and more, which brought up some serious health issues.
Like repeated bladder infections. Last month, after some negotiations, she started using girls' bathrooms. Every Tuesday, Kelver eats lunch with her high school's Sally Club. That stands for Safe Area for Laramie LGBT Youth. She's club president and says safety is a concern in this community.
I do wish I could just go out to like a concert or a party and not worry about my outward image and whether or not the person next to me, you know, is gonna just outright beat me to death because I look too masculine.
Many club members support Kelver's school board candidacy, like sophomore Annika Pelkey.
I'm so proud of her. Like, she's already been so active in it, and she's just like the most hardworking person I know, basically, and I think that she would be amazing for it.
The club's faculty sponsor, William Plum, says he's really seen the need for a policy at Laramie High School.
We've had students who chose not to transition because there was nothing in place or they felt that there was no support.
Last week, the federal government issued guidance to schools outlining civil rights protections for transgender students. State leaders condemned the directives as overreach. Superintendent Jillian Baylow says her chief responsibility is making sure all Wyoming children can learn safely.
Quite frankly, federal guidance doesn't necessarily help that. Those decisions rest best with our local schools.
But Albany County 1 Superintendent Jubal Yenny says the guidance is helpful. To him, it means that Laramie no longer needs either of the proposed policies they've been talking about.
We don't need anything going forward. We needed the guidance. We now have the guidance. So if we'd had this guidance a year ago, the policy conversation wouldn't have come up.
Yenny says a district policy would be overkill because the feds have made clear that gender identity should be protected under existing non-discrimination laws known as Title IX.
Which says, you know, that we cannot discriminate because of race, creed, age, religion, sex, national origin. Okay, we have no policies on any of those, yet we know how to deal with those.
Yenny says until a court weighs in differently, he'll address the needs of transgender students on a case-by-case basis using that federal guidance. But transgender high schooler Rihanna Calver says that's not good enough.
It would be a case-by-case for everything. You have to file a Title IX complaint, you have to have a hearing, and all of that. We could enact a policy that solves it then and there. This is against school policy, and this has to stop.
Calver says a local policy about restrooms and pronouns could signal to the whole community that transgender students deserve respect. She hopes to continue that conversation from a seat on the school board. The election is in November. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schrank.
And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. Catch our next episode on the third Tuesday of the month. If you like what you hear, we'd appreciate a positive rating. And in the meantime, you can find lots more stories about the Modern West at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Connor McCracken Flesher produced this podcast. Anna Rader is the web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.